Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. This year, Wisconsin Cheese is hosting the very first Art of Cheese Festival to celebrate all things curds. Head to www.artofcheesefestival.com for your tickets to Pastured Paradise.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Shelley Lindgren. We'll talk to Shelley about her new book, Italian Wine, and a lot more. We'll taste one of Shelley's tansy wines for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Bay Area native Shelley Lindgren never strayed far from home. She attended cooking school and cut her teeth in hospitality in San Francisco, furthering her passion for wine. Since 2004, she is the co-owner and wine director of San Francisco legend A16. Shelley is a leading voice on Italian wine and is responsible for exposing her customers and the rest of us to new wines from the other regions, grapes, and winemakers of Italy. She has won the James Beard Award for her outstanding wine program at A16. She's written two cookbooks, makes wine at Tansy, and most importantly, is a very active mom. Her new book, Italian Wine, The History, Regions, and Grapes of an Iconic Wine Region, is now available everywhere. And because of Shelley, you will eventually hear of or taste Fiano, Falanghina, Aglianico, Taurasi, Coda di Volpe, Gragnano, and more. Shelley Lindgren, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Hi, Sam. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, by the way.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. We're talking to Shelley live at the Heritage Radio Network Studios at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I had reached out to Shelley when her book came out, and I wanted to have her on to talk about the book, and I've been meaning to get her on the show. And I said we could do it remotely. I could meet you at a hotel, or we could do it at our studios at Roberta's. So Shelley, being the hardcore pizza person, inquisitive person, said, no, we're doing the show at pizza, and we're eating at Roberta's, and we're eating after. So I was happy that, you know, we could sit across from each other. All right, so I kind of know the answer because I follow you on Instagram, but generally, what brings you to New York?
So the book came out about 3 weeks ago now in earlier this year, I just have been planning, building, we've been strengthening our teams at A16, and the release date, we knew it a long time ago, so it was always coming here. We did the James Beard event on Sunday, so that was
leading event. Chef.
Yeah, Chef Yost Gay Machida is here with me. He's actually at Degustibus now. We're doing another regional food and wine pairing.
That's
there.
That's the Macy's.
It's Macy's.
Basement cooking.
Oh, it's the same floor as Santa Land right over there.
Right.
I had Elf movie going through us walking by.
That's funny.
How do you not?
Yeah. All right. So a lot of good things. You're doing some book appearances. You've won the James Beard Award. You stopped by the James Beard Award. So a lot of fun stuff. All right. So a lot of people do know you from your restaurant and events like this and even the books, but there are a lot of people that don't. So get me up to speed. give me a little background on your journey in life and wine that got you to the restaurants and then eventually New York to, you know, talk about your book. How did it all start?
It's so fun to be in New York. It's always, you know, since the restaurant's been open, it'll be 20 years in February.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
No small feat.
I feel like I still feel when we first opened, like I'm trying to still do the same things, work, you know, we're on the floor. We have the best customers. And I realize, wow, we've seen a whole generation grow up here. Now their it's kids true. Come in and I, they, you know, different, you know, same with even within our working team. But we, I've been working in restaurants for a really long time, like over 30 years, like about 35 years, which is, you know, I was young, but I'm from a big family and I grew up in, I was born in San Francisco, grew up in Northern California, and it wasn't really even known to be first and foremost wine country. Of course, there was beautiful wines and incredible families making wine, you know, with great histories. Like I just had a, was talking with Pete Segacio, who's family had, you know, moved in to Sonoma in the mid 1800s. And now he's making cured meats in Healdsburg, but it, and he's, you know, excited to see what we're going to talk about later with the different, what's going on with California winemaking. But I started working in, restaurants. I dishwashed, bust, hosted, became a server, went away to college in San Luis Obispo for a year, finished up at USF. And I was fortunate enough to open the first Left Bank with Roland Pesso, who also had La Folie. And then I moved into the city and I worked for most of the 90s at Fleur-de-Lis and also with Julian Serrano. So I had really great mentorship in chefs. And most of the fine dining was pre.com. It was French. There was Alcarello was open at the time, but, and I did my externship from cooking school there. So they're like family. You know, it's a nice community in San Francisco.
When you said cooking school at that point, you were into hospitality and the food side of it.
I was in the front of house and I was studying to be a sommelier. And then I actually, there was a fire at Fleur-de-Lis.
So there was a wine thought rolling through your head, but you went to cooking school instead?
Yes, I will. I always
loved
to cook.
Was it to compliment it, or you thought you were going to leave wine behind, or you thought you were going to do both?
You know, my one of my first trips to Italy, I didn't grow up traveling like, you know, our kids do and things.
Me neither. Very but, untraveled as a kid.
Yeah. I mean, so I grew up with like eating lasagna with ricotta. That is not the ricotta that we have now. And so when I went to Italy, I really had this light bulb go off. I was already just in love with the history of Italian wine and grapes. And a lot of them weren't really represented in our markets and they weren't on exams for, you know, like they are today. And the quality wasn't where it is today. And
right, so
overall, yeah.
Stop there because that's an area I want to go much deeper in.
Okay.
I want you to finish your chronology. So you had some great, you went to cooking school, you had some good experience with some good people at good restaurants. When and why does
Southern
I
Italy
open my, you go to Southern Italy, you come back and you say, I want to open a place.
Yeah.
Sort of emulate.
My husband already had his first bar. He opened when he was 26. Actually, he was 29. It took him a few years, but they were working on it. And it was a North Beach Basque family style. It was previously a Basque family style restaurant. And the people from Ernie's used to drink there when Robert and Dobby worked there and the, you know, Gotti brothers and the Rujas's who I worked with and things. But so there is a lot of history of wine education in San Francisco. But so he had already opened it. And then we were looking for a pizza and a wine bar. And I had never had Neapolitan pizza because it wasn't really it's not really a West Coast as much as it is on the East Coast.
It wasn't even huge on the East Coast until not that long ago.
Yeah.
It existed, but
it's become, I think, with the world being so much smaller in terms of like information.
Yes.
Like we have, like, you know, when I first was going to Southern Italy, there was no iPhone or Google Maps. And I'm talking, iPhones came out, I think, in 2007. So the world's changed so much. And it's exciting because now you can find these remote places, stay there, visit, explore. And when I was driving around, that's how the A16 got its name. We kept finding ourselves on the main thoroughfare, which is the Autostrada 16 from Napoli to Bari.
So there's the name.
Yeah.
Okay, so that was around the Naples region.
Yeah.
All right, so Italy influenced something that had been burning inside you. You come back.
Yes.
And you start scouting.
I didn't understand how just the simplest ingredients together, you don't need much, but when everything's just right, and it's so handcrafted and fresh. It's just rich
that
lifestyle.
You tasted and
I wanted to recreate,
noticed
bring
and
it
explored
back.
There, right?
Yeah,
yeah.
I was like, we should be able to do this, but like, it easier said than done.
Well, because, they farm differently there than we do. You know, everything's processed flour. They use, you know, they get tomatoes from farms. We get processed tomatoes.
Yeah, tomatoes are religion there, the types.
I mean, so when
everyone's
you came back,
bruschetta is the best one.
You wanted to, you know, sort of present that. All right, so what happens? You start scouting for a location. Does that take long? Do you get up and running? You know, when
we
you
found, we were looking at a few locations, and then we needed the wood-burning ovens for the Neapolitan pizza, which was going to be a big part of the menu.
The ones you see in Italy and now here, the domed ones?
We have one of the, we have that in Oakland location for the Stefano Ferrara, which is an artisan oven. Handcrafted ovens with, you know, volcanic floors on the in there on the pizza to make the pizza, and he can custom tile them for you, and he's amazing. But we wood burning oven in general is not as easy to come by when we really like something's grandfathered in. It had been a restaurant called Zinzino. A lot of people knew Ken Zenkel had opened a Neapolitan pizza, and before that it was like a dry cleaners for 40 years. So there was all this water fountain features in the Zinzino.
Neat.
Yeah.
So you open in around what, 2004?
Yes. Valentine's Day.
You remember that. Did it take a while to find locations, or you looked, saw a few and were able to pick one and get it going? Or
You know, 2004. So, you know, when 9/11 happened, a lot of this restaurant had only, took over, had only been there a short time. It was not the most booming moment to open, but sometimes that's right. When you want to find your location. And so the restaurant that had just, you know, opened up in a short time hadn't really ever had a chance to take off. And right. And so when we got the space in 2003, we had about, by the time you signed the lease and everything, we had like 6 months or less to open it. So it was very DIY.
Right.
Yeah.
You got it open, and your vision going in was executed when you opened. I mean, you wanted to expose the world to terrific pizzas that you saw in Italy and wines that you knew
burrata.
People were.
A lot of chefs first had their first burrata with us, but now we can get it. Things are coming over faster.
So
perishable.
I wanted to ask you, what's different now than then? I guess availability of ingredients.
Yes, but there's more restaurants that are using these ingredients. So,
so you
have to be able to get
dunk.
It. No.
Yeah.
You have to be sure that you can get them on a daily basis and, you know, keep it in stock and as fresh as it needs to be, because it's like Fiano and burrata. If you know, someone's going to order a Fiano di Avellino, I have a like select list that I will pour by the glass because I want you to experience
right.
a really high quality one. Even if somebody said, hey, I'm going to give you this to pour, I wouldn't, and it wasn't from, you know, representative of the way the grape can shine.
Right.
I won't do it.
Representative of the way the grape can shine. How about giving something to someone that doesn't even know what you're talking about?
Yeah.
You know, Fiano.
Yeah, we think backwards as Italian sommeliers.
I mean, God bless you. Yeah. I mean, that's
you
sort of the
Chablis.
Foundation of who you
no problem.
Are, you know, by, you know, bringing all that stuff in. So you get the restaurant going. I mean, do you get it up and running, you know, first year or two without, you know, any
We
major...
had our investors paid back in a year and a half, which is, you know, was
I mean,
our
who wouldn't
goal.
Die for a place like that in their neighborhood, you know, that type of thing.
Thank you. So fun. We have fun. I'm having more fun now than ever, actually. I miss
20
work
years,
when I'm not there.
Which I keep telling you is a feat in the restaurant business and to not be burnt out and to do that. Well, I think part of it may be that you have more than one location. So at what point did you open the second location? You felt comfortable enough and you wanted to expose more people. When does that happen?
Well, we in 2008 also, we were going, when the economy kind of went down.
Right, another
we had been going to La Marque. We were going to do a Marquesano restaurant down by Mission Bay, which is now just really starting to boom. But we were a little ahead of the time when the, you know, economy sort of crashed. And we divested. We just, said we were not, we pulled out. We said we're not going to open right now. Just seemed like, you know, maybe too risky.
Yeah, wrong time.
And it was a big project. So then we already were going to do that. And then Pascal Rigo, who has, he has a company that he had started called Bay Bread and Boulangerie that he had sold to Starbucks later. He had a little restaurant on Fillmore Street that he called me about, and we ended up calling it SBQR. And we opened that instead of the small footprint instead of the Marquesano restaurant. And so I owned and operated that for 12 years. And that had Michelin star for, I think, 7 out of the 12 we were there. And
at SPQR.
Yeah. But amazing. I sold my ownership there in 2019.
Why?
And now, just when you open in restaurants, you never think, where are we going to be in 10 years? You know, what am I? You want to be like busy right away, get everyone paid back and thinking. And then I'm in this for my profession and life. Not everyone involved was.
Right.
And so it just worked out to be the best. Like so we sort of like split ways and, you know, it was the right call.
You actually got at it a good time.
Yeah.
You know, the world changed and it would have been difficult to manage.
Who would have
predicted? Then you had to worry about, you know, your foundation place, you know, A16. Mm-hmm. Another curiosity I had is you're in Tokyo.
Yes.
I
know.
Tokyo has now become the food destination of
it's
the
incredible.
World. And
yes.
It's being recognized, you know, they say some of the best pizza's made there. We know about sushi, other stuff. What was the connection to Tokyo?
Mitsubishi was opening a new, they had a new building. It's called Brick Square down in Marunouchi.
Mitsubishi, the company?
The company.
Okay.
They own a lot of real estate in Tokyo. And they were looking for, you know, here we're Southern Italian, there we're California Italian. So there was this actually stunning location in Brick Square. It's on the street level and there's a courtyard in the middle so you can sit outside or inside. And, you know, they approached me and we went over there and it worked out. And now it's been 14 years.
So it was
years.
Kind of a good coming together that... And that's not the only location, is it?
Yokohama as well.
That's crazy.
And Yokohama was got in the 50 top Italy Asia this year too. So that's kind of a new thing with the Neapolitan. Oh, it's actually not only Neapolitan pizza; it's different types of pizza.
Right.
But you know, Neapolitan is, I think, because it's an Italian organization.
Right.
Like pizza means different to them than it means to Americans. You know, and where you grew up and what you have. So,
We talked off air that you really don't get to New York that much. I'm just curious, do you have to or get to Japan much? Or it's
I get there once
a year.
More
than New York? Or
yeah, probably more than New York.
Same or more. Right. More.
Well,
when's the last time you were in New York?
Being besides in both. Besides June. Yeah.
Yeah.
It had been too many years, actually.
Right.
I was feeling like it had been too long.
That's amazing.
Yeah, the friends I've seen them has been like 5 years, 6 years.
Yeah,
unless they've gone to like TechSom, which I do
every
year, things like that.
That are around. All right, so I'm going to ask you in a bit, you know, how you got to the book, which kind of ties all, you know, this together. But before we get into the book, I have a bunch of questions. Do you remember why was it? By plan, or did you stumble on the fact that you got attracted to wines of Southern Italy?
Stumbled in.
You went on a trip.
I was a blank slate completely.
You didn't plan the trip and say, this, I'm curious about, you got there and then your eyes opened up.
I was learning so much about Italian wine in general, and I'm still learning about Italian wine actually, but I would look at wine books that has a sommelier and actually not know what the wine was. Like, take the Terra Brune wine from Santati. I didn't know what it was. And I asked my friend, who's a wine rep and knows a ton about wine, what's this? I don't know. And then, you know, I was looking at books and most people were asking for Brunellos, Barolos, right. Chianti. But they had these other wines in the list, but nobody really asked about them. And then we were opening, there was so, like, some of the wines I was getting that were older had, some of them had, like, dust on the bottles or, like, broken cases.
I was going to say, does that stuff sit there? It obviously did, right?
A ridiculously inexpensive first opening wine list. And I look back and I date myself because I'll be, like, remembering how inexpensive these wines were and what great producers. And then now there's just... I mean, take Mount Etna, for example. We could get one when we first opened. It was Cota Nera, Barbazale. They didn't have their single vineyards then. Then we got Bonanti, and then we got Paso Pisciaro. And now we have 100. We can do a month and dig deep. And we're new wines coming up all the time. And Contrada systems of 133 that they're going to add 9 more. And it's just a really like a whole... like a changing world that even the people on Etna are like, what, how much are these wines?
So go backwards for a second. You find yourself wandering around Southern Italy. You're tasting the wines. You already had some wine knowledge. What is it? Was it the quality to value? Was it the acidity? Was it the, you know, what is it that like, oh my God.
Yeah. We, so wandering around is really accurate actually. Cause I would show up on people's doorsteps like Antonio Caggiano and Clelia Romano and just be like super fans and saying like because I can get their wine. And there was not a lot of Tarassi out there that you could get at the time, or Fiona d'Avellino. And then same with Bruno Di Concilis. When I found out he had a sparkling wine, I went down after I was just enamored with Pestum and just the thought of the Greek ruins and the stories and the history. And I just like cold called him, and we've been, you know, amazing friends ever since. And he's just thinking, why is she so interested? You know, cause they sell their wine locally. They have big cities around right. them.
So there was a lot of the unknown that you discovered.
Away. Yeah.
Did you know more about Barolo and yeah. Tuscany than Definitely. That area? So you were awoken to a lot of things here that really caught your attention.
Yeah, so curious.
I had to write this question down because I knew I wouldn't remember it or I wouldn't say it right. But what is it then when you first wandered and stumbled around that still resonates now about these wines? Is it more producers, more accessibility, consistency? I mean, what, it hit you then, it's still hitting you now. What is it?
I think just like in everything with Italy, they have artisans, they have family traditions, and they have unique cultures from town to town. It could be like, if you're talking about a dish, it's Basilicata's or a Chete with, you know, Cimino Rape has a Senese pepper on top and Puglia's doesn't, you know, so things
more
like that.
Of that.
Yeah.
You know, that's noticeable to somebody like you.
And grapes the same way.
The book is about that too, you know, mm-hmm. so we'll get into that. I keep pushing things off, but trust me, we'll get there. This is sort of a question that I could ask you when we talk about the book, but it's a more general question. You obviously have a philosophy and requirements, yours, for what makes a good winemaker and good wine. And one of the things that's been buzzing around for a decade is natural wine. Mm-hmm. And natural wine is not something that you tag in the book a lot. The book is only about, you know, wines that are made, you know, very thoughtfully.
Yeah.
So... what are your requirements?
We have a lot of them on our list at A16.
But I'm not even saying, you know, but guys that aren't certified have been practicing, you know, yeah. guys who have been certified. What are the things that, you know, are important to you? You sort of said a few small.
Farming
practices.
Is huge. And a lot of the producers that we're, you know, drawn to in the way that they make their wines, very thoughtfully and carefully, and they care. They want it. They are drinking these wines, and they're living usually on the property of the vineyards. And so, it's you really tell that story. You really feel connected to them. Like when I was doing the James Beard, eight regions, we did eight regional bites and eight wines. We have, and we talk about the grows together on the,
right.
But people really got to live that, you know, through the food and wine matching. And I, you know, no one had had Botarga, and we had like Botarga. We had oven roasted some cherry tomatoes with
Botarga
some celery.
Is what, fish?
Yes, roe.
It's roe, yeah. Egg.
It's like a Phoenician Egyptian origin that was brought to Sardinia. And they press it's like pickled eggs, and they press the roe. And
it's a popular ingredient now,
yeah.
though.
And you shave it on. It's a luxury ingredient, and you don't need much. It goes for it lasts for a long time, but it's distinctive and aroma and flavor. So.
When I asked you the question, you said three things that I always think about and the right way comes up. These are thoughtful winemakers. Thoughtful usually means, you know, thoughtful farming, proper farming, you know, sustainable. Yes. It doesn't have to be checked in the box of organic or biodynamic because they could be doing that anyway. Artisanal. You know, smaller family. I mean, that those are really the things that help answer that question. And I'm gathering, if I look on your list, which I have, there's just a ton of that stuff.
Yeah.
Right. Can you, when you wandered through Southern Italy and it resonated with you and you made a life out of it when you came back, I'm just curious today, is there a region like that anywhere that's yet to be discovered or is totally underappreciated or?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Throw me one or two things.
Okay, so I would say in the north, probably Val d'Aosta.
Okay.
And so it's the tiniest region, but it's really like the Italian side of Mont Blanc, Monte Bianco. And then you go like one valley, extreme viticulture, where you have the smallest growing season because the snow comes early, melts late, and those are the grapes that had survival of the fittest right there. And they're amazing, like Pré Blanc.
And
tiny, tiny, tiny producers there.
Tiny producers produce a certain way, not a ton of stuff on people's wine lists, not on the tip of people's tongues, mm-mm. which is where the wines that you've been, you know, championing were similar.
Even Calabria, it's a big region, but it's hard to find the wines.
Anything outside of Italy that comes to mind to you?
Oh, I am a wine geek in general, so I love things like, I'm an island lover, like Canary Islands.
Okay, I think Canary is here, though.
It's here, yeah.
Corsica, what's the next Canary, you know, guys like Envinate, they're, you know, established.
So good. I think Eastern Europe's going to be, Kate did a book called Lavash a couple of years ago. So she got to go to Armenia and really see like some of the origin of winemaking in these caves. And was, you know, since we've been writing and traveling through Italy for the last 20 plus years, we've been having fun with the book events because we can go back and forth. You want to tell the story? You want to tell the story? And it's just so much fun. So with Armenia, she was like sending me photos from, you know, really old places where wine is also being rediscovered right now and allowed to be made. So.
I think you're right about Armenia. I mean, I'm reading more about it and the varietals and people are liking them. And I think it's a good story. I agree with you on Eastern Europe too. They're sort of having their time now. The Dalmatian coast, Croatia, Turkey, all these great places. I didn't ask you this before when we were talking about the restaurants, but how is San Francisco now? I mean, if you're here, and I know better than to believe everything.
I know.
It's the end of the world. Like people come to New York and say, don't get into a taxi. The guy will get, don't go to San Francisco. It's shut down and home. You know, you're an operator there. Mm-hmm. You know, that vibe can affect your business.
Yes.
I mean, tell me the state of San Francisco, you know, now and how it sort of affects the business.
I think, you know, maybe like on the coast, we're exposed to a lot more from international travel and people coming in for different reasons. On a city like San Francisco, we're very open, welcoming, and everyone has a lot of rights. You know, we want to make sure people are looked after. Nobody wants to see anybody homeless. It's a big problem, but I think it's getting better. And I think there's a lot of people focused on what that means and how to make it better. I mean, I have a freshman, one of my sons is a freshman in high school. And last year he learned how to ride the bus because the students, you know, ride for free. And he's all over the city eating everywhere and trying new things. Yeah. And he didn't learn that from me. He learned it from his friends. And they're just like having
good for them.
It seems like they're having a normal childhood and they are used to seeing homeless, unfortunately. But
they're a little tempered by that.
Yeah.
But they're not coming home screaming, oh my God,
they're empathetic and they care, but they also are like, this is the reality they're growing up in.
Right.
And they
understand it and accept it to some extent.
Yeah. They are learning some street smarts, but also like I'm really proud of the decisions they're making and that they're doesn't deter them from going to kick the soccer ball down at the fields and things like that. So
I always grew up jealous of city kids, even though I live very near to New York City right outside. It wasn't, living in the city. It's a cool thing. It's a more worldly kid. All right, Shelley, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Shelley Lindgren. Shelley is the proprietor of A16 restaurants in San Francisco, Japan, the San Francisco area. And she just wrote, is it your third book?
Yeah.
Two cookbooks and a book about Italian wine, and rightfully so, because she is one of the experts. And it's not just about, the areas that we talked about. It's everything. So when we come back, we're going to talk to Shelley Lindgren about her new book, Italian Wine. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Cheese lovers, assemble! From September 29th through October 1st, Wisconsin Cheese is proudly hosting their first ever Art of Cheese Festival this fall in the home of cheese, Madison, Wisconsin. Over the course of the festival, you can learn how to pair cheese like a pro. Art of Cheese is thrilled to offer classes on pairing cheese with wine from industry's leading sommeliers, cocktails from spirits experts, chocolate, and coffee, yes, coffee, from a former cheesemonger. At Art of Cheese, you can level up your artisanal cheesemaking knowledge with a curds-on deep dive amongst the cream of the crop and celebrate all things cheese by dancing the night away as the belle of the Wisconsin Cheese Ball. You won't want to miss out on this pastured paradise. Run, don't walk, to www.artofcheesefestival.com to snag your tickets and cheese the day.
All right, we're back. We're back with my guest, Shelley Lindgren. Shelley, let's talk about the book. Let me state the whole title. Italian Wine, which is how we're going to refer to it, but the book is called Italian Wine, The History, Regions, and Grapes of an Iconic Wine Country. All right, so I need to get what I call the vitals out of the way, okay? Why and when did you decide to write the book?
So the first two books were half, they both covered all of Italy to get collectively. But like the A16, we covered the islands and like from Abruzzo south. And we included Abruzzo because they mainly use olive oil in their cooking.
Right.
And that was like our deciding factor and like how we have built these fictitious boundaries on the wine list for different reasons. So that covered that. And then SPQR book covered the other half of Italy and regions and wine. And then 10 Speed at first wanted us to write a Southern Italian focused wine book. And then it changed quickly to be an all encompassing, just Italian wine book without the food component.
Well, although we do have. Where did the change come from? Them, dishes. You, just. It was a better idea or
it came from actually that came from me because I even though the South of Italy is really as like my heart is there. I love all of Italy
right.
And love drinking Italian wines and learning about them. And I wanted to do just cover everything. And Kate and I decided to organize it in the way that we have it in the
two
parts.
So when was this? Was this, pre-COVID?
Oh my gosh. This was, so let me think about this.
Talking 5-6 years ago?
No. This was 2014 was the first time we talked about it. 16 is when we said, okay, this is when we're going to do it.
And when did you technically sit down and start putting it together?
Right about the 16, 17.
Okay. Did COVID have an effect on writing it and releasing it for you?
It did. So we originally had a 2 book that we were going to do together. And Kate and I, we started, Italian Wine was like the big one. And then we had a little one that was me, Food and Wine Pairings. And it was called, it's called Wine Style. But during COVID hit and I could not.
Put that down?
It became a, 100% Kate's book. And it's done really well. Yeah.
It happened, Wine Style.
Wine Style happened.
With Kate. When did that publish?
That came, so she was, that came out, I think, in 2021.
Okay.
I think.
Right, kind of in the middle of COVID. Mm-hmm. So how long did it take you guys on this book?
Yeah, so with me being at the restaurant every day, except for the 1 week we were shut down, I was there morning to night, early to late, and we didn't do to-go before. We could sell retail wines. And so we did all kinds of creative ways of selling our products and making it fun for guests. Like we did a bottle in a box at first and, a bottle of wine and pizza for $25. Smart. And there was a wine friend who was like, how can I help the restaurant? And they gave us a really good price on the wine so we could still charge it. But we were really thinking we wanted the guests to have fun. And what can we do? Because this is all new for us.
Right.
And then I started a wine club, which we just stopped because the book came out. So it was supposed to follow the book. So we did each region. And you'll find that if you were a member of the wine club in your reading, you'll be like, I remember this story or something like that. So I just think that it helped me focus on wine through the wine club because right. I had this, I could write about, those are the regions we focus on in the book to cover, make sure we had all the information we wanted. And then it was a lot of just emailing back and forth with Kate and I constantly.
Now, a tough time to travel, and you had traveled extensively, but did you do any specific travel? Did you have to go back somewhere, or did you travel for the book, or your body of knowledge was so there?
Yeah, I've been to Italy. I've been to every region many times, some more than others. And
more
usually,
than Kate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. But Kate and I have been together on the trips many times for over years, and they're usually like road trips to corners that we laugh about today because it's like, we got off the wrong island. We're going to Ischia. We get off at Procida or whatever. And then we have to figure things out. So my last trip there before COVID was 2019. It was about a 6-week trip, and Kate met me for about half of it, and then we went down and then she had to get back because she also had other books and things she was writing. And so that was the last time before the book came out that I went to.
So from then to the book coming out, you hadn't traveled there?
No.
Okay.
Because we turned the book in. It was, maybe I did go to, the Veneto to Prosecco Superiore last October.
Okay.
So
it's a testament to how much travel you did in advance. I mean, one of the reasons you could write the book is, like you said, you've been there so many times.
And the producers also make their way to visit the restaurants, and we host dinners and taste wines, and we ask them questions.
Right.
Like you're asking me.
Right. Right. That's cool. This is a semi-low blow question.
Sure.
But you could certainly handle it.
Okay.
But it's a pitch question.
Okay.
And, I want you to be thoughtful about it.
Okay.
You and I know a bunch of people recently have written books about Italy. Good people.
Yeah.
The Joes. One's older, one's fairly recent. A lot of people have written books where they extensively include, Italy, whether it's Raj or Aldo Somma or any of these other guys. Tell me you obviously, when you sat down to write the book, you wanted to take, why is this book different? How is it different? You know, what are you trying to do?
I think that our approach is the book's separated in two parts. So the first part, we're history buffs, not buffs, but we really love history and grapes and Italy. They tell you so much. And then when you take the country like Italy, it's like the most biodiverse country by like long shot. And so we, Kate and I had discussions, and the reason why it's organized the way it is you can, it can be a reference book, but we cover climate, we cover grapes, we cover history. In the beginning, the first part just goes like an abbreviated overall history of Italy and the history of wine in Italy. And then you go to, that's just understanding Italian wine. And then we go to, we start with Abruzzo and we go all the way to the Veneto.
So A to B, 20 regions.
20 regions.
Side question, because I want you to stay on the main. Is there just 20 regions or you cover 20 regions?
There's just 20 regions.
It is 20. Yeah. I wasn't sure. Yeah. I knew you would know the real answer. Okay, so history, then regional. But within the regions, you discuss sort of a format, you know, the same thing in each. Just tell me quickly.
We try to give equal opportunity to the different regions. I mean, some are small, like Molise, so there's less to discuss because not as much happening.
Of course.
But we didn't like, we didn't want any the regions to be really overshadow each other, but we also didn't want to, you know, not put in as much information as we can that's relevant. So if you have, if you're going to, if you want to know about Calabria, it tells you all about the whole region. But we also put references and indexes in the back that we find really useful for people who want to study all the DOCGs, which are constantly changing, or, you know, go, we have recommended.
Tell everyone what a DOCG is.
Oh, yeah, okay. That's the place
DOC,
of origin.
DOCG.
Yeah, it's like DOC, DOCG, but, and it matters. I mean, we're doing a class at A16 in a couple of weeks, and I put food and wine recommendations. I'm going to take people through 10 regions. Two of them, they said they were like, they don't have a DOC, so I can't use them. So Italy really pays attention to this, but winemakers can make a choice.
But the quality of the wines in those areas
that
are not part of the organization, there are still thoughtful, artisanal, small guys you know,
the best.
So that's, there's
so
a whole
good.
Politics to that
thing,
which we're not going to get into in this show because that's a show on its own. We're going to jump on everything you just said, but I think you did establish the difference. I think history is important in this book. And there's a bunch of history questions I have. I mean, people think of Italy and they think the history goes back to the Romans and the Greeks, which it does.
It does.
And, you know, nobody could look at a map and figure out what country was what and what emperors were ruling. But tell me if I'm wrong. A good starting point is, for our intensive purposes, our drinking, owning a restaurant, what excites us, from the 1960s on, things really started ascending. Tell me, you know, why that time and what the ascension was.
Well, World War I and II were huge for Italy. There was a couple things where there was like a lot of depopulation and people emigrated to places like America or in South America, especially, and, you know, both, and, you know, like we have in San Francisco, it's a lot of, people from Lucca, Genovese, Calabria, some Sicilian, and that's like mostly here. And then you have New York, you have a lot of the Abruzzo, Napoli, I mean,
Sicilian,
yeah, tons of Sicilian, but you know, just with the 1960s, what happened was a lot of people had left all the vineyards and farms, and you know, I mean, there's, it goes back even farther, but they needed to go get work in the cities, is what happened.
So, and the rural thing collapsed a little.
It just, the economy was depressed, and.
Right.
And almost like some parts were almost like third world countries in the south of Italy, which one time had this glory days, you know. And so that's about when areas like, let's say, Alto Piemonte and Bocca area, people weren't really in the, after Industrial Revolution too, people left, you know, making, it was like a big I know they make clothes and garments, and they still do, obviously, like Italy with its clothing.
Big fashion country.
Yeah, big fashion. The Barolo really built up, and that was like 60s, 70s, and what we get to see today. And some of those producers go back farther, but in terms of every stone being unturned and the crews and knowing where all the vineyards are, that's modern day wines.
Right.
And, you know, they were in Piemonte, they were trading, you know, trading in French because France is so close that everybody spoke French there. And that was the way of,
right,
of
Northwest
time before. Yeah. So it's the history is just incredible because that's where a lot of products came from during like Marco Polo and Venice and the Venetian Empire there,
right,
to, you know, getting ingredients from South Italy. But wine is...
Well, you say that wine making started in Southern Italy.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, the mention of Altopiemonte, Barolo, Barbaresco, yeah, even Tuscany, I mean, it was kind of happening then.
I mean, the Etruscans were making wine.
Okay.
They were. I mean, absolutely. But, there was tribes of Italy that were making wine, and there was definitely grapes in Italy. But when the Greek Empire came to Calabria and the South Italy, Basilicata, Sicily, and, you know, wherever you see like a K, because there's really not a lot of use of K in Latin. And so...
What is the K?
K is Greek.
Oh.
Yeah, there's a lot of K in Greek. And when you see like, you know, the old spellings of certain things, you know the Greeks were there.
Right.
So, but that was really where they came to Calabria and said, this is a land of wine. It was like vine poles is how they, in Otria is what they called it. And they thought it was a sign from the gods because they have their god of wines. And, and so they brought that back into Greece. And it was a lot of grapes and viticulture were a lot of the trading of the seas back to Phoenician times too. And, you know, that... You could go way, way back, but really in terms of bringing grapes in the grape viticulture, the Albarello system, and some of the Pasito winemaking and things that come from, you know, evolve from, you know, when you're studying like, you know, Western history, it kind of starts in Greece and then in the way we learn it here today, you know.
Right.
So it's the same for grapes.
When you look at the 60s and forward, did people return to rural areas? Did they get their eyes back on native grapes?
Yeah.
You know, farming, not screwing up. I mean, did all that
That's
stuff
a good question.
Start?
I love that question.
Did it all start, you know, evolving better then?
Well, I always think that, I mean, from where I'm sitting, like some of the poverty in the south of Italy before, you know, they really started focusing on indigenous grapes and realizing, oh, we have our own grapes. Just because the world right now wants Chardonnay, Cabernet, we don't have to plant that when we have our own grapes. But there was a time in the 80s where other, you know, some of the more known regions or places like, you know, for instance, like Sicily, where the grapes can grow in such large quantities, you know, that's like a lot of people would buy grapes from Sicily and Puglia.
You mean more output per hectare than it just?
Oh yeah, just there's just
Sicily
grapes everywhere.
Sicily is known for that. Okay.
Oh yeah, it'd be top.
So it's hardy.
It's hardy, and they wine is grapes. Everyone grows grapes there, and I mean now more than ever too. But a lot of people were purchasing grapes to blend into like Northern Italian or I mean, Northern European wines from France, from like
Venice, Vitifera. Yeah.
So there's a little bit of Italian wine and most wine. I'm kidding. There's no, there could be. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. But I do think that some of the less international, some of these Southern regions had less international grapes just because it was like it was a monetary thing.
Right.
And
you were forced to figure out what's
here. You just made
your
own wine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's part of the answer, but Italy, like nowhere else, the growth and progress from as far back as we talked to the 60s to the present is so affected by history. I mean, it seems it's more Italy. Maybe France has some, but I mean, do you agree that just the wine progress and growth is so history?
I agree.
Connected?
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
Italy's pretty much, it's a young country, but has a deep history, like very
it's
old
young
history.
As it is, yeah. But a lot of stuff went through. Yeah.
Yes.
So finish
yeah, boundaries
your thought.
Change yeah. and things and grapes, you know,
different
get
countries
shifted.
Running it.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
That's pretty interesting because I guess because of all of that, you know, history. And like you said, I mean, the book starts with a historical background. We talked about the fact that the book covers 20 regions. Mm-hmm. Which is nice because it's not a book about Southern Italy, which maybe one day you'll write about, but you have. But it's like you said, Abruzzo to Veneto.
Yeah.
So it's the 21
It's comprehensive,
regions.
Definitely.
We talked about the format, you know, there's a historical background. And then in each section, because you're such a foodie, at the end of the section, which I love, you recommend producers mm-hmm. in every region. Mm-hmm. And, you know, spot on in my mind from the little I know. You basically, if you're a wine lover, could look at a book like this and just purchase, throw a dart at any of your recommendations.
Oh, people
and
have been doing that
you'll
already.
Bring home,
I'm so
you know, great
happy.
Wine. But there's
I get
also
photos of wine labels all the time.
Yeah, oh, sure. And then there's obviously the food aspect. You know, you've written cookbooks, yeah. you're, you know, mm-hmm. very tuned into food and wine. You talk about food in each region, how yeah. availability or
just classics, dishes that you can expect to see, or if you want to try to make them at home and you want to get recipes. We didn't do recipes in this book, but
right.
we just write down if you're in Rome, and I say if you're in Lazio, what are things that you might find there? If you're in Friuli, what are you going to eat?
I was yeah. just in the Alto Adige.
Oh, amazing.
I love the region. Didn't know yeah. much about it. Got invited, did podcasts. And I didn't realize that's like the home of spec.
Yeah, that's
and
the home spec.
And spec is, you know, at the back of your thing and all that. So, I mean, it's a pretty good travel guide
yeah.
too. You know, if you're looking to pick wineries to visit or to buy or food, I mean, it's pretty good that way. And it gives you all that orientation. All right, let me ask you a bunch of questions, because really the 20 regions, like we said, are Abruzzo to Veneto. They follow a format, and they're very intensive as far as the information. And to that point, when you look at the 20 regions, what's the region that really has your heart, which is really, you know, I'm asking you who your favorite kid is.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Or a few.
Yeah,
you know, you don't yeah. have to, you know.
Well, you know, I feel like on the last trip I went, I hadn't really spent time traveling through Abruzzo like I had. And it's so magnificent. And also, I'm a huge fan of Matera and Basilicata. And also, I would say when you visit... Most people visit Rome, but they don't always
they don't,
go
they
around.
They do the touristy stuff.
Yeah,
they don't take wine into yes. consideration?
They just
so
don't.
So what should they do? I mean, tell me the wines, yeah. the regions, even drop a winemaker name.
One of the main reds is Cesenese. So we have a photo of the book of Damiano Cioli. Just a
spell Cesenese.
C-E-S-A-N-E-S-E.
Cesenese. Okay.
Cesenese.
And that's kind of...
It's
a Roman. You're gonna when you're around
yes,
Rome, you'll
yeah.
see Cesenese. Okay,
and you could go visit. It's like 30 minutes southeast of Rome. There's a beautiful pre-Greek native Italian town called Cori, not far away.
Spell.
South Cori.
Cori,
and there's an incredible producer named Carpinetti there, and they
C-A-R-P-I-N-T-I.
P-I-N-T-I, yeah.
Probably, yeah.
And they have local grapes that are like Bellone, B-E-L-L-O-N-E, you know, Nerobuono, like, you know, just beautiful grapes that you really don't see that often. But if you tasted it, it would taste familiar. There's some, you know, Frescati had a big, was really well known for a long time, but then kind of like Verdicchio and Suave, they got a little, less focus on quality, more on quantity because
Right.
It was, you know, they would sell it in a very inexpensive price, but you could still get tons of great value. And those wines go great with food. I'm a huge fan.
Well, it's cool because more people travel to Rome than a lot of the wine regions we talk to.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people are into wine. So there are great opportunities, you know, to taste wine in and around, you know, Rome that are sort of indigenous to that area.
Oh, the list in the restaurants, they'll have all these wines.
And coming from you, it's a high recommendation. All right, what region, this is like lightning round, what region has the most diversity in varietals, climate, soils? You know, one place that kind of runs that whole gamut.
I would have to say Campania.
Okay, so variations in climate.
Mm-hmm.
The soils go one place to another. You're talking different compositions.
Yeah, there's volcanoes.
And grape varietals?
Yeah, grape varietals too.
All right, so if you're looking for that diversity, Campania. All right, was there a region that, for the intensive purposes of writing the book and your knowledge, was more difficult to cover or write about? You knew less about it, or people weren't as cooperative? Or I mean, do you walk out of here going, whoa?
You know what? I thought was going to happen, and the opposite sort of happened, where I left Tuscany to the end. Because I was like, I'm just going to let needs his time. I'm just going to let it, you know, there's so much history. But then actually it was less complicated than I imagined. It had so much fun talking about the feudal systems and all these things. It was magical.
So you pushed it aside for those reasons.
Yeah, I pushed
and
it aside.
When you got there.
I thought it was going to be harder, and it was easier.
Well, again, that's a testament.
But the opposite happened too.
How?
So when I got to Friuli, which I've been many times, but to talk about it is like a really it's a very strong history, and it's, you know, you want to do it justice and be, you know, talk about things of like, wow, that was really war torn there. And, you know, the Cold War, that's like on the other side of that boundary was
cold. People don't think about that stuff.
Yeah, the cold, and then the wall came down. It was sex, drugs, rock and roll right there, right? So, like,
that's a good one.
Good.
All right, last question on this. And, you know, I asked you before, tell me regions that were like southern Italy when you went there now. But tell me, this is Italy. What region should we be paying attention to now? Which I guess is what's exciting you now, or what's a little different now than maybe years ago. And what region, and it may be the same, is underappreciated?
I would say underappreciated, I would say probably Calabria or Molise. And Calabria has so much
Molise
potential.
Is Molise M-O-L-I-S-E?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. They have a grape called Tintilia. It's hard for me. I'm looking for it and I can hardly find it.
All right, so Calabria, tell me about Calabrian wine. Like, tell me about some of the major varietals and even
so
throw
exciting.
Me a maker.
And I've been saying this for years, but time's not moving so fast there right now. It's just like, but there is, you know, we recently poured an incredible wine from a producer named Giovanni Calabrese. And that's his name is Calabrese. And it's called Polino, and it's a grape called Malioco Dolce. And it is outrageously delicious.
Red
so
or
good.
White?
I red.
Mean, like,
there is a
Malio.
Malioco.
Malioco.
Dolce.
Spell.
Maglioco.
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 Okay.
Maglioco.
All right. Just for all intents.
Yeah. And we're just blown away by how beautiful it is from one of Italy's largest national parks right in there. It's where you get the porcinis, truffles. And I think people think South Italy that everything's going to be very hot and big just because it's South Italy, but it's a lot of times it's not that at all.
Really?
And the Gallioppo is a great expression of that. It's one of the most ancient grapes and also apparent to, they found out Sangiovese from DNA.
So very cool history and connection.
Yeah.
That's a good one. That's about a good answer.
Okay.
As far as substance,
yes.
As any. You
I mean,
know,
look for the Chiro. We just special ordered one to pour by the glass because in the A16 book, I mean, it's like a couple producers reached out to me over back then, it was just like the internet. They're like, who are you? Why are you selling so much of our wine?
Right.
I mean, we love it. It's so good.
And, well, that's what you're all about. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's the highest compliment, you know, the acknowledgement from the maker, which is really nice. One thing that caught my attention is you mentioned in the book that alcohol in Italian wine has increased by 1%. And there's always reasons why the alcohol levels go up and down. But you cite climate change.
Yeah.
Now, you and I could do a whole show on climate change in general, climate change in Italy. But that's a tangible thing.
Yeah.
How are the growers adopting to this change? First of all, are they recognizing it, and are they starting to adopt?
Yeah, and I mean, it's a you know, generalization, because there's so many grapes in Italy,
right.
And the climates are always.
But
I mean, I would say take Piedmont and Tuscany, for example. Sangiovese and Nebbiolo are hardy but delicate grapes, and so I could use California for the same example, where the old Cabernets were like 12%, like Bordeaux too, 12%. Now you're seeing 14-15% in there.
That's going backwards a little now, right?
But I think that the winemaking quality is so high that they're able to pick earlier. They're looking for the grapes who are not like trying to get that out of the grapes.
Right.
Like, and they were like certain trends where, you know, Chardonnay was very big.
Right.
It wasn't really acid, wasn't really the focus.
Cabernets.
Exactly.
You know, high alcohol, unctuous.
Yeah. So I think that there's a few producers like Sergio Germano from Germano e Torre, who, you know, has vineyards where his grandmother's family had them, and they're incredible, like the Lazzarito vineyard. But he's been planting Tempranillo. And
oh, wow.
I tried it, and he makes it like it tastes like he mixes Barolo. So it has a very much more red fruit.
So it's a different grape with the same
style.
Process and
yes.
style.
But he did that thinking about climate change, because just forward thinking, like, will I need to adapt that way? So not that everybody's doing this, you know, now, tomorrow, but they're thinking, well, you know, Mother Nature plays such a big part in the vineyards. So, you know, they may be adapting, and other places where they didn't get as ripe in Gran Sasso and Abruzzo, they're excited. They're getting that ripeness, you know? So it's just depends where you're at, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's everyone's going to handle it differently. And like you said, you know, every region. I mean, there's been this new market of sparkling wine in England. You know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, they're making wine.
I'm with you. Really, I just hope everyone, you know, can figure out to the best of theirs, because it ain't going away.
No.
You know, it's not going to stay or, you know, get cooler.
Yeah, record heats every year.
All right, so we're talking to Shelley Lindgren. We've just been talking about her book, Italian Wine, which does a deep dive into the history, which has an important effect on wine in Italy. And she really gets deep into 20 regions. And like I mentioned, it's pretty good travel guide, pretty good reference, you know, not a book you hide away. All right, I want to talk to you about a few other things other than the book. In front of us, we have a wine that you make at Tansy, and Tansy is your wine. So tell me, you know, what Tansy is. Yeah. In a few minutes, we're going to taste it and evaluate it, but tell me about how Tansy came about.
Tansy came about in the pandemic, you know, as we were all thinking of ways to survive through that time. A friend of mine, who is my partner here, Kitty Osaline, she was part of a group that was concerned about restaurateurs and what's going to happen to our industry? We have a great community of people, and she was there to help, actually. So we had thought of, she was also a sommelier and was coming from the tech side of things. But we started with thoughts like Prosecco in a can. You know, it was always a wine related, because all I talk about is wine, Sam, actually. No kidding. Even my, smell my water. I don't know. We got, but we, I,
smell this, your water. Yeah, hey, that's Pinot Grigio.
Yeah, go there ahead. You go. Kitty and I started talking. We started talking about, actually, canning wine's not as easy as it sounds. And
it seemed like that was maybe the interesting move.
And we had talked with someone, a Prosecco producer, and we're talking about all these things we could do. And we said, you know, we live right by wine country. And I have a good friend named Megan Glab, who is very passionate about Italian varietals. And we have a love affair with Fiano. We've tasted over the years. And so, but I was really like pretty, you know, locked down in the restaurants, every day. But Kitty met Megan and really like did a lot of the legwork to get us to a point where we could actually bottle wine. And so we worked with Megan about the Italian grapes. We could source organic single vineyard, the things that are important to us. We're an all female brand that has every part of it is like, even our photographer who've taken the labels. It just so happened that we have a theme behind this woman-owned brand. And so we started with Vermentino from Las Brisas. We had a Fiano from a producer in Russian River that Megan found like, and loves.
Yeah. Fiano is a love of yours.
Yes.
Like how many acres in Northern California?
Not many.
I mean, are we talking like under 50? How about under 10?
How about under 10?
Oh my
yes.
God.
Not much.
And you beat Dan Petrosky to it or something?
Yeah, I beat Dan to it. No, Dan gets the Greco and the, he Ribolla Gialla.
Right.
Yeah,
he has, that's his
Yeah, thing. He's the best. I love him. And no, but we're all like-minded and friends for this reason. We're really
well,
into
it's
it.
It's a common passion and love.
Yeah, and this is our newest one. We just had our third vintage, actually, which is hard to believe, but still young and just starting to go into markets now.
So let's not evaluate it now, but this is the Tansy
Falanghina,
and in a few minutes you'll tell me about the grape and the wine and pairings and all of that. So Tansy is up and running, third vintage, continued plans of, you know, making these Italian varietals, women-owned business and all of that. I'll ask you at the end of the show, but now's a good time. If people want to know more, where do they go? To the website?
The website, Tansy Wines.
Tansy.
Yes.
Wines.
Wines.
.com. Okay. And we're going to taste that in a minute. All right. We're going to wrap up the interview part, but I want to do the wine list with you, and then we're going to taste the wine. I'm curious about you, Shelley, because I know the restaurant business is as crazy as ever. As a mom of two boys at a very kind of demanding, important, and interesting age, you know, when they're little babies, you can kick them around. But these, like you said, one's started high school and all that. These are men now.
Men.
You know? Tell me about your work-life balance. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're very dedicated to the restaurant and wine, and I know as a mom, but how does that, what's the real, you know, part of all of that? Is it just
Well, they work with me. No kidding.
they wash dishes. They actually, they're chained to the sink.
No, they want to, they really have the work ethic and they want to work. They see us working really hard, but it also, they've become friends with everyone at the restaurants. They're
So they're embedded and engaged in that kind of environment and lifestyle. Mm-hmm. You must love that.
I love it. Yeah. And it's fun to see their relationships with other people that they're learning from because they, you know, honestly, like they don't want to come to the restaurant and be like, that's my mom. Although like we're close, I'm working, you know, and they're like, they have, you know, they want to watch soccer games with the Italians and they have their own conversation about who loves which team. And he'll come by and show his soccer cleats to Dario, you know, and then my older son, he works and he's a pizzaiolo and he also
he's making pizzas.
Sometimes 100 at
an
event.
So a lot of your connection and exposure to them physically is through the restaurant.
Yeah.
Do you have time to sit home and have a dinner on the weekends or, you know, everything's so frantic, but you're hanging with them at the restaurant.
I mean, I like to bake, so I always have the cookie jar full of cookies, you know, and I got, we connect, but I think even at this age, I'm really feel like grateful. They're very responsible, fun.
They're good kids.
They're good kids.
Yeah.
They have a lot of independence.
They must be familial if they're gravitating towards the restaurant and hanging with you. They want to be part of that, which you must love on the inside.
Yeah, and like they sent me like the like since I've been here, they're like, "Oh, you're walking into New York with like a picture of Christopher Walken," and I'm like, "They're funny." I was like, "I love that."
That means they're thinking about you and they care about you when you're not there. That's great. All right, before I subject you to the wine list, I have one last question that I kind of can't let you leave the studio with, and the question is. Wine and pizza pairing.
Ooh, yes.
And I'm going to simplify this because I know wine pairing, you could have a piece of salmon and say this, but once you put a sauce on it, it changes. So I'm going to stick with two things and you change it. A pizza margarita, which is basically cheese, tomato sauce, the dough and all that. And I don't know about you, but in New York, whether it's slices or takeout, pepperoni pizza.
Okay.
Okay. Now there's magnificent other pizzas and we're at Roberta's and we'll probably try some, but you like the Bee Sting, which has Supersod on it with honey. Pizza margarita, couple of the best pairings. And this is from Shelley Lindgren, who makes pizza and knows Italian wine better than anybody.
It's I take his pizza pairing so seriously. So I'm like,
come on.
Best question.
Margarita.
Nerdavola. And
Nerdavola. NERODAVOLA
Yes.
And that's from?
Sicily.
Okay. And that's a red full-bodied?
It's medium.
Medium-bodied.
I call it medium full.
Thank you for correcting
me. It can be full. It can be.
Tell me why that works.
So Sicily, in the Nerdavola is you have sun ripening that is gives it a little depth of flavor to go with the sweet and tanginess of tomatoes. But you add that mozzarella and you want a little something to go with the fat of the mozzarella, but also has enough acidity to highlight the tomato sauce, which is huge.
Right.
And
big part of a margarita.
Yeah, so I've actually made friendships with chefs over pairings like that because
All right, so Nerdavola. All right, now we pull out the pepperoni pizza, which is cheese, tomato sauce, little oily cups of pepperoni. What goes with that?
I mean, I would go to Galeopo, which we were talking to.
Galeopo? Yeah. Nobody ever heard of that.
No,
spell it.
But it's a G-A-G-L-I-O-P-P-O.
Gag?
Gag.
Leo.
All right. No, like a churro.
Wait, G-A-G-L...
G-A-G-L-I-O-P-P-O.
P-P-O. Gaga.
This is the home of Andua, which I don't always pronounce right, but...
where is it from?
Calabria. They like their spice there.
Calabrian Galeopo.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, these have not been recommended by other people with these questions, and take these to the bank.
No, I eat this. This is my life. Pizza is
so,
like, definitely...
I know Nerdavola's... In at least the big cities we talk to, San Fran, New York, Chicago, you know, and the list goes down, Nashville, Newark, whatever. Is Galeopo available?
Yeah.
And, okay, so you can get, is it a quality to value thing? It's not expensive?
It's not as expensive. It's, you could get different crews and things, but you're still probably, you know, there's a lot of quality out there. When you find it, you'll be happy with it.
Yeah. I'm happy to turn people onto that. All right, Shelley, this is our wine list. Five questions. We've asked the same five questions to everyone who's come across the show almost 300 times. Be spontaneous. Please do not dwell on the answers. We got to get out of here. So the first question is, what are you drinking now? What's in your fridge? What are you curious about? This is separate. Maybe it could include the restaurant. You're also in New York. Maybe there's things in New York that maybe you don't have access. Or what are you drinking now? You could say beer.
I had a great Timorosso the other night, and that was delicious.
Timorosso is from where?
It's from Piedmont, And they've been planting it a lot more, like right outside the Barolo.
Pinarosso's the grape.
From Piedmont, yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Everyone thinks of Nebbiolo.
I drink a lot of Etna Bianco, too, right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That makes sense. All right. This is the silliest question of the group, but it's probably the most perfect question for you of anybody. Favorite wine and food pairing? Not something you eat every day, every week, but what's that ooh-ah?
Favorite wine and food pairing.
Yours, not what you think is a great, you know, what works for you?
You mean if I'm cooking at home or out in a restaurant or just like, doesn't matter.
What? I can't believe I have to hold your hand on this one.
No, okay. If I was going to do a favorite.
And what food is the ooh-ah pairing for you?
If I was going to take sea urchin on a pasta. Sea urchin pasta. And I would take something from Marco de Bartoli, like a single vineyard, like Grappoli de Grillo, and put that together. And that's like an ooh-ah for me.
Now, sea urchin pasta is usually sea urchin, the pasta, and what, a little oil? Or it's pretty simple, right?
Yeah. Simple.
Okay. So it's really that salinity of the sea urchin and that mild.
And it kind of emulsifies a little, too.
And the wine works well. Why?
So it's also made by the sea.
Okay.
Light, so, rich, pretty.
Not that this is exactly, but what grows together goes together, you know, from the sea.
Exactly.
From the sea, salty. Okay, good.
Mm-hmm.
You travel a bit. What's your favorite wine restaurant and our bar anywhere? Let's start with when you have time to get out of San Francisco, where can you go and get a meal with good wine? Or where can you go to get a good glass of wine besides your place?
In the California or in?
Anywhere. Let's start close to home and then someplace that resonates to you.
Okay. I would say go to.
And I'm going to disclaimer this by saying this isn't your favorite. It's a recommendation. I don't want you to go home and say, I heard that stupid podcast and you left me out. It's not about that. It's just what comes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
No.
Screw that.
I mean, I like so many places. I think I recently went to Zuni and had champagne and oysters, and that to me is
you're not allowed to give that answer.
Okay.
But that's okay.
It's okay. No, but it's for like a wine.
So Zuni,
which
is classic to the umpth degree, having a little champagne and wine there. You didn't even say their chicken and Pinot Noir, which
we could have gone. I didn't get there yet.
Okay. Give me one other one.
Yeah, because I give you another one.
Any place? How about Italy?
In Italy.
Is there a place in Italy that like you always think about, like the food is great in the wine list, or it's just a great wine bar?
I've had so many incredible experiences. I went to a place in Tuscany on the sea called La Panetta.
Spell Panetta.
P-I-N-E-T-A.
Panetta.
Great.
Okay.
And
that stop right there. That's the type of place I'm looking for. All right. We're going to move to the fourth question. The fourth question is, what is Shelley's favorite all-time wine? In the old days, you would have been a perfect candidate for this because I was looking for, hey, what's the rarest, most expensive wine you ever drank? You're exposed to everything. I don't give a crap about that. Here's what I care about. What's that one wine from beginning till now that had the most impact on you, that was life-changing, that was a gateway, that opened up your eyes? It doesn't have to be one. It could be a couple. But is there a wine and a time that you had that you could still cite now and say, you know, when I had this, blah, blah, blah?
Oh, my gosh. So many. I think when I was...
Whatever
when
pops into your
when
mind.
I was really young and I first had like an older Bordeaux, like a 59 Latour, I was working at Fleur-de-Lis and I didn't understand that wine could age that long. I really didn't know. And now I've been on debates on...
You know, 59 Lafleur. No, wait.
Latour.
At Lafleur.
At Fleur, yeah.
Fleur.
Exactly. At Fleur-de-Lis,
So 59. All right, So had you drank a little Bordeaux before that?
Yeah, I was selling it.
Okay.
But I was it was in my mid-20s, and so I was still, you know, I wasn't what my favorite wine was then and what it is now is completely different. So
is there something now, like we talked a lot about Southern Italy and finding your way there and wandering around and championing it. Is there a wine then, now, where it's like this defines, you know, what I feel or think? Is there a winemaker?
There's so many. There's so many. Right now, I think Abruzzo is having an incredible moment.
Okay.
Where there was just a couple producers we all knew and loved, like Valentini, Mato Pepe. But then you have people like Cristiana Tiberio doing this over 100-year-old Trebbiano d'Abruzzese. That's like absolutely mind-blowing.
So that's a great answer, because in that answer was Tiberio, Pepe, and
Valentini. Yeah.
And not the easiest wines to get anymore, not the cheapest, but a great example of any wine and a great example of that region. So those definitely, I may have Chiara from Pepe on.
I love her. She was just in A16.
I know. I'm excited about that. All right. Fourth question. You just answered. Fifth question, you should be as good as anybody on this question. No pressure, all right? I want you to recommend to me the best wine around $15, $20, $22. I want you to recommend a red and a white. It could be category, it could be maker. Like Pascaline and I decided that Muscadet is a great answer for the white, because if you go to the right place, it's a good wine. It's not that. So that's a category. Then she'll say like Pepe or what. Give me your recos. My kids are in their late 20s and 30s, a little older than yours. Yes. They don't want to bring crappy $14 supermarket wine to a party as a gift, but they're not spending $40, $50 yet. So how do you wow at 2022? White, red?
For white, I would go to Falanghina from Campania. Duh. So good. So, I mean,
okay,
But I would go to from Campania, because that's the most planted white there, and their quality is great, value is great.
And we're talking in New York or San Fran, finding a Falanghina for $20, $22.
Yep, easy.
Okay, perfect. Give me a red.
For red, I would probably say something like a Montepulciano d'Abruzzo.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that falls in that price range?
Yep.
That is a terrific, you know, recommendation. That could be a good gateway wine for, you know, a lot of other stuff. All right. I didn't mention this, but I will post Shelley's wine list answers online. We do a special posting. And if you go to our Instagram page, basically for the last 3-4 years, I have everybody's answers in the tab above. So we'll be doing that. And I will also list what we're going to talk about next, which is Shelley's Tansy wine. So every week, when it makes sense, we taste a different wine on air. Now, when somebody's making a wine, we taste their wine and talk about it. If you're a Somm, I would say bring a bottle, and you are. Bring a bottle that's representative of your program, you know, and you would have brought a Falanghina or a Fia. But we're going to taste your wine. So this week we're tasting Shelley's own Tansy wine, which we talked a little about. So tell me a little specifically about this wine. We talked about the winery and Megan and who was it, Kate?
Kitty.
I know. All right, so we're tasting. Yes. Tell me first, give me the specifics. We're tasting the Tansy.
This is a Falanghina. So Sam Bilbro is managing a new vineyard, and it's a first year for all of us, him included and Megan. It's called the Rancho Coda Vineyard. It's in Russian River, but it's higher elevation, and it is organic, biodynamic. And we are so excited about this particular vintage and being able to have it. We're just like, we're over the moon.
So
about
how much, what is he growing? Like a
tiny, I don't
tiny
know.
Amount. Well, how did you come across?
We only have 75 cases of this made.
Okay.
This one, because of Megan and Sam. And well, Sam knew about the, our project and our focus on, California, I mean, Italian varietals in Northern California. And it came out great.
Tell me, before we get into the wine, just tell people about Falanghina, you know, what the characteristics are, you know, what generally you're going to get out of it.
Usually, so it's one of the oldest grapes in the Campania region, and it means phalanges, like your fingers, because when the Greeks were sort of like colonizing and growing grapes, they found the Falanghina grapes that were coming, like they were wrapped around stakes from the ground. So they thought they looked like fingers. And so they named it Phalangina. And it usually has a characteristic, like a maybe a nectarine quality to it. But this one has a really bright acidity. And they can, well, in Campania.
Is it a wine known for its acidity?
Yes.
Like decent acidity,
yes.
Always, right?
It grows sometimes in Campi Filigri, which is on the north side of Naples, where you're looking back at Vesuvius. It's like a crater of Naples. So it's very volcanic and loves minerality. But it also grows very well in the Benevento, Sannio area of Campania. So it can get a little riper there and have less acidity, but it doesn't need that. It might age a little light and be a little lighter from the Campi Filigri, but it's not a heavy white, and it's rarely an oak. And it's one of the ancient grapes of Campania.
So he's farming very thoughtfully, organic, mm-hmm. biodynamic,
amazing.
No low intervention in the cellar.
No.
No, you said no wood.
No. Nope.
So it's stainless steel tanks, mm-hmm. and all that. All right. Let's give this a sniff and throw it over the tongue and let's talk about it. So first, let's talk about the color. It's got a nice yellow golden.
Yeah.
Not dark, not light, mm-hmm. but definitely presents a nice color. I suck at this. You're the expert. What do you get on the nose?
Well, I definitely get that kind of nectarine
you
quality
do get the
too.
I do too.
And maybe a little bit of lemongrass is because it's acidity. And there is a yellow flower component.
The lemongrass is nice, but subdued.
Yeah.
All right. Mouthfeel. Kind of a, it's not light. It's certainly not heavy. It's got a nice medium negative or
it
whatever.
It hits all over your palate. It's just really high in acidity. So you feel that kind of pucker.
I'd say it's
pucker.
A medium. Maybe medium. Yeah. It fills your mouth.
When it's colder, it feels crisper. It's we're having like.
Yeah,
you know,
I don't mind a wine. To me, it's a better representation.
Me too. I like this temperature too.
This is actually good. Yeah. It's sat in the glass for, we've been talking an hour and 20 minutes.
Right. And in a ride from Manhattan.
That's right. But it was cold when you got here.
Yeah.
What do the palate descriptors replicate any of the nose descriptors you gave me? What do you get on the palate?
I do. I get that.
You get
same,
that nectarine
yeah,
too?
I do. I get it.
You get that citrus.
Like that peach pit. A citrus, definitely like a white grapefruit and mandarin quality to it.
So there's acidity to this, but it doesn't jump out of the glass to me. This seems like a medium acidity. Is that accurate? Or is how do you evaluate this?
Yeah, I think for Phalangina, it tastes very close to how an Italian representation.
Yeah,
it feels
delicious.
Like it feels like it should.
It's delicious.
Thank you.
So you're very happy with the way this came
yes.
out.
Yes.
Okay. What foods?
It was our first one, so we didn't know.
Your first Phalangina.
It was our first Phalangina, and we didn't know. We tasted it, and we were like so excited.
Well, you're talking like it's the first time we closed our eyes and took a sip. You're not talking about three slouches.
I get excited
here.
About
yeah, but you're
it.
Not talking about three slouches,
no.
Megan Glaub.
No,
I mean,
no.
You know, you're in San Francisco dicking around. She's there going, I can't screw this up, you know?
Yeah.
So you got the right person and all that. What do we pair with this?
Ooh, you could do so many things. I would say that this is a great salad or appetizer course kind of wine or a seafood dish. You could do a
it could hold
fish
up
piccata
the,
if you want. Yeah.
Piccata is lemon with capers.
Yeah.
It'll hold up to all of that, right?
Yeah, I'm a big capers fan.
Me too.
General. Yeah.
I like the big ones.
Yeah, they're so good.
Eat them like grapes.
Yeah, something salty like that would
yeah,
be great.
Yeah, it's perfect. It has the body to hold up with it.
Yeah.
All right, so that, give me the year. It's which
2022
Tansy Phalangina.
Yes.
Is it available online?
Yeah. It just was bottled last month. So.
Oh, so this is a treat. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I caught you early enough where I made sure you can get a bottle of this. All right. We have to wrap up, Shelley. Let me do a quick wrap up and then I want to ask you for some info. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you like the podcast, leave a positive review. We appreciate you for that. Follow us on Instagram @sbenruby. Follow us on X. formerly Twitter, at Ben Ruby. I know those are two different addresses, but they're very close. But you can always find us at the hashtag The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, we'll post Shelley's wine list and weekly wine sip selections on our social media sites. Let's talk about the book for a second. If we want to purchase the book, where do we go?
It seemed to have a lot of shops around. I saw it in most bookstores.
Your small
bookseller. Yes,
go exactly. Into town and buy the book.
There's some great
bookstores
here.
And you're actually doing some appearances at places like that, right?
Exactly.
And if you can you get it on Amazon?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So go to your bookstore first or go to Amazon. You post on Instagram personally. Where do we find Shelley? At Shelley Lindgren, right? Okay.
Exactly.
And then Tansy is at tansywines.com.
Yes, exactly.
So if we enticed you about this Falanghina, you could go online and order it.
Yep.
You have a mailing list.
Yes.
You have...
We have wine club mailing list.
All of that stuff. And if we are traveling... Oh, by the way, on the books, if you look up Shelley Lindgren or go into a bookstore, they'll show you the SPQR and the A16 cookbook plus the new book, Italian Wines. If we want to find out more about the restaurants, where do we go?
A16pizza.com.
Okay. Yeah. And that'll get you everywhere. Like we said, there's multiple locations in the Bay Area and in Japan. All right. Did we miss anything on the info part? All right. On a final note, on some of our upcoming shows, we're coming into wine festival season in New York City. We'll be talking to Byron Bates from Wild World. We're going to have Raj Vadi and Daniel Johnson to talk about La Fête du Champagne and La Table. I'll be at Caractère doing interviews. That's where I may be able to talk to Kiara from Pepe. She's in town for that. And I will, as I do every year, chat with Isabelle Legeron in advance of the Raw Wine Festival. So those are some of the shows that'll be coming up. You'll see everything on social media. I want to thank our guest, Shelley Lindgren. Shelley, for being so easy on the invitation. I saw the book. I said, I got to have Shelley in here. I tried to talk to her at the Charleston Wine and Food Festival. She got back to me right away. She said, this will be fun. She said, I'll record in the studio. I'll be in New York. I got the whole day ahead of me. We could sit there and do whatever you want. So thank you for that, and thank you for doing the show. As always, thanks to our engineer, Armin, and everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.